difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to The Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and how it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm regular universe Keith Phipps here with...
Tasha Robinson Noir.
Genevieve Kosky.
And the spectacular Scott Tobias Ham.
Every week we get together to talk over a classic film and consider how it relates to a current movie. This week we'll be looking at two different takes on Spider-Man, the superhero created by writer Stan Lee and artist Steve Ditko. The first offers a reverent take on classic Spider-Man comics and comes from a long ago time when it wasn't yet apparent that superhero movies would be a big deal for years to come, the distant past of the year 2004. The second is in theaters now and takes Spider-Man, the character and the idea, in directions neither Lee nor Ditko ever could have imagined. Tasha, can you tell us more?
It was a sweltering June Friday in 2004. The humidity hung in the air like the sweat of an angry god, and I wanted some relief, so I ducked into a downtown movie palace. The marquee read, "Hot dogs and healthily cooled air." Frankly, those mattered to me more than what was playing. Something called Spider-Man 2.
Okay, sorry, I don't know what came over me there. I was trying to talk about the first film in this week's pairing, the Sam Raimi-directed Spider-Man 2, a sequel to his 2002 hit Spider-Man.
Is it possible you were taken over by the spirit of an alternate universe Tasha Robinson?
Yeah, it's certainly possible. I mean, especially if the reality we live in bears any resemblance to that of the second film in our pairing, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, an animated film that offers a kaleidoscopic spin on the Spider-Man story by teaming up a freshly bitten teenaged Spider-Man named Miles Morales with the burnt-out, embittered Peter Parker of another universe, then bringing in a gaggle of other Spider-Men, women, and pigs to do battle against a series of deadly foes.
Thanks, Tasha.
Kid, it was my pleasure.
We'll be back after the break to dive into Raimi's Spider-Man 2.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So where you been, pal? You don't return my calls.
I've been kind of busy.
Taking pictures of your friend. Spider-Man killed my father.
No matter what I do.
Do you love me or not?
No matter how hard I try.
I want Spider-Man dead.
It's the ones I love who will always be the ones who pay.
I can't keep thinking about you. I'm getting married.
I want a life of my own. I'm Spider-Man. No more.
You look different.
I let things get in the way before. There was something I thought I had to do. I don't have to.
I like seeing you tonight, Peter.
Now into the main event.
Octavius is going to put Oscorp on the map in a way my father never even dreamed of.
Crazy scientist turns himself into some kind of a monster. Four mechanical arms welded right onto his body.
Who takes Spider-Man's pictures? Where is he?
It's taken me off your loyalty to Spider-Man and not your best friend. Bring Spider-Man to me.
How do I find him?
Peter Parker.
Find Spider-Man, or I'll peel the flesh off her bones.
There are bigger things happening here than me and you.
We're going to be talking about Spider-Man 2, a film from 2004. But before we can do that, we first have to pay a couple of visits to 1962 and 2002. The first is the year that Stan Lee, with artists Jack Kirby, Steve Ditko, and others, began filling Marvel Comics with a new sort of superhero, a vulnerable, sometimes quarrelsome, and often neurotic bunch that bore a greater resemblance to those reading the books than superheroes had ever done before. Lee and Ditko's Spider-Man would, within a few years, become an instantly recognized icon. But Spider-Man's success owed an awful lot to the relatability of Peter Parker, a troubled, bullied kid who discovers he has previously unimaginable powers after he's bitten by a radioactive spider. But to paraphrase a famous Lee quote, his new powers shackled him to new responsibilities. They also didn't free him from anxiety or unhappiness. Peter Parker is a character defined by his fear that he'll be unable to fulfill his obligations to his friends, his family, or the city of New York. He hates to disappoint others. yet finds himself doing it all the time. Flash forward to 2002, and the first big screen movie to star Spider-Man after years of attempts by filmmakers like James Cameron. Raimi's Spider-Man is faithful to the look and feel of classic Spider-Man comics. If the 2000 film X-Men suggested a superhero movie could stay true to the spirit of a comic while also connecting with a wider audience, Spider-Man confirmed it. The film retold Spidey's origin story and found a cast that seemed like the embodiments of Lee and Ditko's creations. Tobey Maguire is a sensitive, wide-eyed Peter. Kirsten Dunst is his neighbor and almost-girlfriend Mary Jane Watson. James Franco is Harry, a rich friend with a connection to Spider-Man's arch-nemesis, the Green Goblin, and so on. Audiences flocked to it. Gratuitous Macy Gray musical sequence and all. A sequel was inevitable. Which brings us to 2004 and the overachieving sequel Spider-Man 2, which improves on its quite good predecessor in every way. The scope is widened, the effects look better, the color palette is deepened, Sam Raimi is looser with the direction, and the dialogue feels less beholden to the cadences of comic book dialogue. Most importantly, however, it's an emotionally richer movie. In Dr. Otto Octavius, it finds a genuinely sympathetic bad guy. One is motivated by loss as Spider-Man himself. And it gives Peter a storyline that finds his powers failing him as he loses confidence and decides maybe he's better off not being Spider-Man. Maybe, in fact, the world is better off without a Spider-Man in it. It's sophisticated stuff for any kind of blockbuster, and an early sign that the superhero movie could tell complex stories with rich themes, becoming a high-water mark for the subgenre that subsequent films, even Raimi's Spider-Man 3, have sometimes struggled to match. Raimi took a gamble similar to the one taken by Lee and Ditko 4 decades earlier, believing he could craft a superhero movie that could handle the weight of heavier material and making a film that proved it. Like Lee and Ditko, he took kid stuff and helped it grow up.
You'll never guess who he wants to be. Spider-Man.
Why?
Well, he knows a hero when he sees one. Too few characters out there flying around like that, saving old girls like me. Lord knows, kids like Henry need a hero. Courageous, self-sacrificing people, setting examples for all of us. Everybody loves a hero. People line up for them, cheer them, scream their names, and years later they'll tell how they stood in the rain for hours just to get a glimpse of the one who taught him to hold on a second longer. I believe there's a hero in all of us. That keeps us honest, gives us strength, makes us noble, and finally allows us to die with pride. Even though sometimes we have to be steady and give up the thing we want the most. Even our dreams. Spider-Man did that for Henry, and he wonders where he's gone. He needs him. Do you think you could lift that desk and put it into the garage for me? But don't strain yourself.
Okay.
All right, everyone. I hadn't seen this movie in a few years. I really enjoyed rewatching it. How about everyone else?
Same. Mm. This is a movie that I have seen several times, but like you hadn't watched it in, I don't know, probably close to a decade. Mm-hmm. I feel like it was on TV all the time for a while there. So I watched it many times, but haven't revisited it since we've kind of reached peak superhero movie and maybe past peak superhero movie. So within the context of the last 5 to 8 years of blockbuster superhero movies, it was very interesting to return to and to see how much of it still works really well, even the parts that look decidedly different today than they did mm-hmm. back then.
Yeah, I feel like you don't really need to reach back in the past for your superhero movie fix anymore. Yeah. revisiting these is not an urgent matter and causes that in some ways. But how about you, Tasha?
I had sort of a mixed experience with it in that I've come to really enjoy the Tom Holland version of Spider-Man, mm-hmm. and watching him play that role in Spider-Man Homecoming and Infinity War, I felt like initially when he started turning up as a Spider-Man that he was echoing Tobey Maguire's performance here. Now going back and actually watching Tobey Maguire's performance, it seems so much bigger and goofier than Tom Holland does. The whole film seems so much bigger and goofier and Sam Raimier than I remember it being. And that sort of doesn't sit well with me. Like, I've never entirely enjoyed Sam Raimi's, like, injecting slapstick into his serious material. But at the same time, I'm really surprised at how good this movie looks, particularly with the Spider-Man effects. I mean, you can tell that you're looking at a CGI effect most of the time. But when you compare it to some of the, like, the MCU wireframe characters today, it looks really good. You know, all of the web swinging sequences in particular just really get across the physics of Spider-Man, like, how web slinging would work, why it would be fun, his habit of going woohoo whenever he's swinging around is really enjoyable. And that train scene, man, I was a little out of the experience of watching this movie, just like, you know, kind of half analyzing it, maybe half laughing at it a little bit. Train sequence still chokes me up every single time.
Well, we'll get to that. Yeah, you're right about that, at least. but how about you, Scott?
I think this is my favorite superhero movie, period. I don't think I like any superhero film more than this one. It's just so stylish and crisp, and it's got a great villain, and it's got a lot of emotion, but in a lot of whimsy. The performances by Tobey Maguire and Kirsten Dunst both are, I think, ideal. Perfect. I mean, God bless Tom Holland. I think he does a fine job with the role, but there's something so bold about casting Tobey Maguire and having him do his Tobey Maguire thing in the role of a superhero. I think we've taken for granted how radical, I guess, that performance is in a way. You know, and I think it establishes immediately what the conflict is, and also in a way that's kind of like disarming too, about him trying to deliver pizzas and not quite getting it done, and him having to live this crummy workaday life, and you know, just showing, hey, it's not really all that glamorous a thing to be having to save people all the time, and then in the other time that you have, you know, you're inadequately doing your job, and you're not paying the rent, and you're not having a relationship that you want to have. I mean, I think the film really gets all of that so nicely. It's a terrific movie, I think.
Before we get too far away from the performances, I don't want to skip over to Alfred Molina, mm-hmm. who I think probably has the highest level of difficulty here, because watching this movie again, I had forgotten how much Doc Ock talks to nobody in this movie, just like stares at the horizon and delivers speeches. That's obviously, to a certain extent, born of comic book style and dialogue. And I think this movie is indebted to the comics medium in a lot of really interesting ways. But you need to translate that sort of, you know, villain monologue to the screen the way it is here. You need an actor with the gravitas of Alfred Molina, but also like not overmuch gravitas. You know, I think it's like he has a really good balance with the Doc Ock character.
And it's an interesting, like Raimi requires a lot of interesting things from him, because I mean, I've written about how superhero movies have a tendency to put both the heroes and the villains into the same emotional place where they don't feel anything except like anger or fear. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it all turns into this, you know, gray nothing. You look at something like X-Men Apocalypse, where you cast somebody as good as Oscar Isaac and then mm-hmm. bury him under makeup and never let him change expression. And then you compare that to this, where he's doing the full-on like villain arms in the air, you know, I shall conquer, like full-on operatic comedy horror villain. Mm-hmm. It's a really diverse performance.
I think it helps he gets there by degrees too. Like, he's very down to earth, may not be the right word, but he's very, you know, recognizably human character as the film opens. And it's got a nice marriage, he's got aspirations, and then, you know, some bad things happen, and all that kind of starts to fall away, you know. I think you're right, it's done very well. I mean, you kind of struggle to think of a better comic book villain in the big screen. I mean, like Michael B. Jordan in Black Panther comes to mind, and not a lot of others. There is a perpetual problem of villains making them
Tom Hiddleston
compelling.
Loki, always a blast. Yeah. But yeah, so few of these characters are allowed to have personality. Mm-hmm. They're just met as a big growly threat. Molina's Doc Ock, I mean, say what you want about him, he's definitely got personality.
Well, I mean, and the thing that connects Doc Ock and Killmonger is just you understand their thinking from the start.
They
you
get backstories, or they get origin stories.
They do.
Along with the heroes.
And I mean, and there's such a thin line between this scientist who genuinely wants to do something extraordinary to help the world and to you know, change the way that we, you know, use energy, and someone who's just so overcome by hubris that he's this world destroying villain. The film articulates that so well. And one of the things that hadn't been brought up is the effects of those arms is so brilliant. Like the use, his interaction with those devil on your shoulder type of attached arms is just such a smart choice and such a very Sam Raimi choice too, right?
And the way they're anthropomorphized too, they have like almost have like little faces. You know,
they have separate personalities. Yeah. That was part of the design, was like each one of them has a separate designed personality.
Yeah. They gave me kind of Audrey 2 vibes.
They're super Audrey 2-ish.
Yeah. For sure. I like how much horror stuff is in this, how much like Raimi's background is in it. Like there's actually a shot of a screaming woman running at the camera.
Yeah,
it turns into, and that one sequence just basically turns into an Evil Dead movie.
Oh, for sure, too, chainsaw and all, man.
Yeah, but it doesn't break. I don't think it breaks with the tone of the film, though.
I mean, I think it sets the tone of the film because that's really, I mean, things go bonkers when the fusion reactor gets out of control. But that's a much more like, you know, mechanical CGI driven set piece. The mayhem in the operating room is much more organic and much more character focused. Like you get little slashes of personality from a lot of those different people, including John Landis as the doctor, I believe.
Oh, yeah. I saw he's in the credits. I didn't recognize him in the film, though.
Yeah, the main speaking doctor that's like, does anybody remember Shop Class?
Yeah.
Interesting.
That sequence is like very quintessentially Raimi, but watching it too, I was kind of struck by how, again, evocative of the comic book medium it is, because like that is an action sequence that is choreographed very similar to the way a lot of action sequences are in comics, like almost in panels. You know, it's like, and now here's this arm, and now here's something happening over here, and they like all kind of feed into each other, but you don't necessarily get the big picture the whole time the way you do in the sequence with the fusion reactor going berserk. You know, that feels a lot more like something you'd see today in a superhero movie, a blockbuster, whereas the operating room sequence feels like it is kind of like going back in the other direction toward the other medium, you know, at play here of the comic book panel.
Raimi just seems to come about the comic book movie so naturally, stylistically, because you think of something like Ang Lee's Hulk, which is a movie I admire in a lot of respects, but I mean, that movie is like, we are going to try to recreate a comic book here that is going to be the style of film, and with Raimi, it feels much more organic to the way he's making the film, and every once in a while, you get these really beautiful, you know, tableaus that he set up that are striking and evocative of a comic. I'm thinking of the end of the movie with Mary Jane in the spider web, and just the way that whole thing is framed is so beautiful and so dynamic, and so, you know, it has so much personality. I mean, that's, you know, of course I'm going to start complaining about superhero movies today, but like that's the one thing that's missing is direction. You know, I mean, this film is so directed and so much a Sam Raimi film, in addition to delivering the goods as a comic book movie.
At the same time, the plotting is so goofy. I mean, the whole business where Doc Ock can rob a bank of its giant bags of gold coins.
And coins. Then, I was like, why is this bank like Scrooge McDuck's vault? Why are they dealing only in gold coins?
They're dealing only in gold coins left in giant open sacks. And he steals a couple of them. And then he goes to the Villanorama, apparently, and buys like particle accelerators, R Us, Tinker Toys with his bag of gold coins. Like, where do you go as a villain to drop off a bag of gold coins in exchange for science crates?
But you don't want the scene with like the gold coin fence or something that he has to go through.
Hey, I want villain. An entire particle accelerator. Like, that's going to take at least two bags of gold coins. Chunk.
But what's more comic book than just a sack of coins with like a little money sign on it?
That is super comic book. There's also the whole thing with Mary Jane's marriage, where she's just like, I met a guy. I'm dating a guy. The guy's proposed. We're getting married in 5 minutes, and there's nothing you can do about it.
And then the scene right before that where she's like, it's not that serious, and like the very next scene engaged.
And like all of a sudden she's addressing wedding invitations.
I've somehow forgotten all that stuff because it is so marginal in this film, and it is kind of like last minute at the end. It's like, oh, this is actually a thing they have to deal with and not just some sort of thing she's talking about. Mary Jane's not actually delusional.
She feels delusional at times, though. There's that sequence after he sees her play where they're walking down the street and he's like, hey, you want to get some chow mein? And she's like, you can't just come to my play and try to break up my marriage. It's like, lady, I said chow mein, not drop your fiance and run away
with
me.
But in fairness, that is what he was after.
That is what he wants, but it's still, it's okay. Like, she's not Mike Pence. She can go to dinner with a person of the opposite sex and have it be friends. And she blows the heck up at him just instantly. How dare you suggest I should get chow mein with someone who's not my fiance?
I think Mary Jane's motivations are not this movie's primary concern for better or worse.
Can we work more Mike Pence references into this podcast?
Because
that was an unexpected twist.
Understand? If I do have an actual serious objection to this film, even that's overstating it. There's a little too much nice guy going on with Peter, and I know that he's the quintessential nice guy, and we're supposed to appreciate him for that. But there is just this kind of like favor sharking feeling about his, like, I'm going to hang out in the background and make sad eyes at you, and like you shouldn't go on and live your life because it's going to make me tremendously sad. I'm not going to express how I feel. I'm not going to do anything about like any of the things we've ever talked about. I'm just going to stand here and mope. And there is a degree to which I can only sympathize with that so far. I know great power, great responsibility, but you know, also if you want something, at some point you got to take steps toward it. I think that the strongest part of the movie.
He's so busy.
He is super busy, man.
And he's so broke.
But the strongest part of the movie is when he's just like, you know, okay, I'm gonna actually do what I want. And he does it for a little while and sees the consequences.
Two movies with that song.
Yeah.
I know. Well, apparently it's a deliberate, like the part where he's fixing his bike and the wheel goes out the window apparently is meant as a direct reference.
I do like, I know you were a little down on it, Tasha, but I do like the kind of slapsticky nature of the humor in this. I really love the little thing of him battling the brooms in the broom closet for like way too long.
Yeah, that's
I completely forgot about
it.
It's
so unnecessary and so fun anyway.
And yeah. How much were you thinking? Hand her the pizzas and then fight the brooms, man. You could still get there. Come on, let the brooms fall where they may.
Yeah, he was already like 4 minutes late at that point. Mm-hmm. But speaking of, there's also like the good pizza gag when he's actually as Spider-Man and he like goes back to grab the slice. Mm-hmm. The skyscraper guy.
Yeah, from Scott Spiegel, who was in both Evil Dead movies. This film, if there's like a speaking role where the camera lingers on a face for more than like 3 seconds, it's probably a name you know from another Raimi film.
Well, and you get two Talk Soup or the Soup hosts. You get Joel McHale and Hal Sparks. I'd forgotten existed rewatching this film.
And I was watching this with my boyfriend, and like, and the credits said, you know, Asif Mandi, and we were like, wait, he's in this movie? And he was like literally the first person on the screen in the movie. We're like, oh, yep, he is in this movie.
And Bruce Campbell is the usher that won't let him through the door. And Ted Raimi as J. Jonah Jameson's. I picture him going to his brother and saying, can you put me in any role that will let me just hang out with J.K. Simmons like throughout shooting?
Well, but, no, don't forget Elizabeth Banks either.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Well, exactly. Baby Elizabeth Banks.
Yeah, and Dennis Farina. No, that was the other one.
Daniel Day Kim. Obviously, Stan Lee's got his cameo. Brent Briscoe is the guy that shows up with
let's just read the cast list.
Dylan Baker, right? Dylan Baker's his teacher.
Dylan Baker, poor Dylan Baker. He's seated in all three of these Spider-Man movies to be Turnip as the Lizard and never does.
It's like Billy Dee Williams getting set up to be Two-Face and then just not getting that chance.
Yeah. So we got Tommy Lee Jones' worst performance ever. We should talk about a few things here. We mentioned the train scene. I think that's, you know, if this isn't the greatest superhero movie ever made, and I think that's certainly in the discussion, it's got to be the greatest scene or it's a top three superhero movie scene. I mean, it's the set piece itself is exciting, but what it builds to emotionally is just incredible. Like, Tasha, you know, obviously you've had the worst attitude toward this film. Yeah, it's still worked on you. Well, why does that scene work?
But for the same reason that George R. R. Martin's stuff works, except with less rape and death.
Keep going.
Yes. I'm subscribing to your newsletter.
This is something I've also been writing about for a long time. Back to AV Club days, like George R. R. Martin, I firmly believe that the reason he has built such an audience is that he builds his stories around like profound injustice, and then he just keeps piling on the injustice until one person does a kind thing or a generous thing or an altruistic thing or even just the just thing, and it feels like the biggest relief in the world. You know, you spend the whole movie like watching the universe pile on Peter Parker. Like, he can't help his aunt, he can't keep a job, he can't be with the woman he loves, he can't explain to his best friend, like, who is in agony, what's going on. He can't tell J. Jonah Jameson to take a hike. He can't do any of the things that he wants. And then the city looks at him and sees him for the first time and says, we love you for what you have sacrificed for us. And we will do anything for you, up to and including save your life, by getting in the way of the villain. I mean, it's just, it's a tremendous payoff for everything he suffered, and it's a huge emotional moment.
Are you just on, a kid. Mm-hmm. How about that line?
You on, are you on board with the Christ imagery?
I mean, sure. Why not? Put it in.
Why does Superman only get the Christ imagery? Spread it around.
All superheroes are Christ. Then the little kid, who I believe both of those little kids are Tobey Maguire's half-brothers, saying, we won't tell anybody.
No, I didn't know that. Everyone's in this movie. We have two big picture things to talk about, and whatever else we want to talk about, too, because it's a fun movie to talk about. But which do you want to go first? We talk about how this fits into the history of superhero movies and how it fits specifically into the Spider-Man trilogy, which means talking about Spider-Man 3.
Well, I have almost no recollection of Spider-Man 3. So
I've rewatched it fairly recently.
Would you like to exercise those demons and then we can telescope back out to the big picture?
The film has its defenders. I really want to be one of them because I do like Raimi so much. And I like the other two films so much. I'd love to say, you know, you need to give it another shot. And it starts out fine. You know, rewatching it, it starts fine, but it's just such a mess. And like all like sort of the niggling plot, the silliness that we've kind of touched on a little bit of this that work in this movie that just don't work on it at all. The climax makes no sense. There's the whole emo Peter Parker sequence and that's no good.
Got something to say about that.
I don't know. I'd love to be a defender of that film, and I just can't. But how about Tasha, tell me why it's great.
I honestly wish I could come in with that level of contrarianism. It would be so very, very sweet. I also have very little memory of it, but the emo Peter Parker scene where he's like strolling down the avenue with his guy liner and his smirk and his newly dark hair, watching Spider-Man 2 again, where he has the sequence after the Spider-Man No More, you know, straight off the cover of the comic book that had that arc. Immediately after that, when they do the raindrops montage, it's a musical montage where he's walking down the street, like feeling good and expressing himself to everyone around him, just like, you know, hey, I'm living life now. The emo musical sequence made so much more sense to me going back and seeing that sequence, because it's just it's meant as a dark comic echo. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And people dissed on it so hard, but I think Raimi knew exactly what he was doing. Like, people didn't like it, but it was a bookend, it was a reference to himself.
Yeah, it just doesn't work. That's the problem. It tries for, you can see what they're going for with a lot of this movie, and certainly the Sandman as played by Thomas Hayden Church is similarly sympathetic in theory, at least. It just doesn't work in the film itself. Scott, do you have any thoughts
on that? I haven't seen it since it came out, but it was disappointing. I think it does what happens with a lot of sequels that try to do too much. It just kind of collapses under its own mm-hmm. weight. I think you see that happening time and again with franchises. I mean, Spider-Man 2 is this remarkable movie in that it is extremely busy. It does have a lot of sort of balls in the air, but it's under control. He manages the whole thing. And I think
sort of a fusion reactor.
Exactly. That's a good, right. Exactly. This Spider-Man 3 is a fusion reaction going out of control. I do really like the first one as well. I mean, I don't want to like dismiss that as some little crude formative thing. I thought
it's good.
It is quite good. And those were a lot of those initial conceptual risks were taken and paid off, and it's got, I hate to use the word iconic, but it has a few you know, moments out of time that people remember, and that's all in the filmmaking. So I still have a lot of affection for that movie too, but Spider-Man 2 is kind of where it all comes together for me.
Listen to your keynote, Keith. It occurred to me, and this maybe brings in the question about the history of superhero movies, but like this and the X-Men franchise were like kind of unfolding concurrently, and mm-hmm. And they really did kind of, you know, travel a similar arc with like a good to really good first movie and then a really great sequel and then a third movie that like kind of goes off the rails. But the fact that like that was sort of the template that was being set, I do wonder how much that affected our current superhero movie paradigm of like the first movie is just the first movie, you know, we're setting up for the thing that comes next and the thing that comes next and probably end after three. I don't know if any modern superhero franchise has gone past three without rebooting.
I mean,
not including your group.
I mean, X-Men's like its own weird super continuity or something. Yeah. But
yeah, I think it, like I said, established a paradigm that maybe we're still sort of seeing the echoes of today to a certain extent in terms of like having a really great sequel. Because with superhero movies, like the first movie, you're beholden to a certain amount of origin story stuff.
Table setting.
Yeah. 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 And
who is Thor?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, and with Spider-Man, you have to do the spider thing. You know, I love this movie because there is no actual spider in it for once, which is always a danger with me and Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. So, you know.
Well, that was something the first movie handled well, though. That just that origin stuff was all, it was mm-hmm. an absolute pleasure in the first one when he does all of his woohooing and, mm-hmm. and you know, initially starts, you know, slamming into building walls before he figures out how to fly. Also, I'm also very pro. Let's just crack open this argument, baby. I'm very pro organic web shooters.
Really?
Not into it.
He's a Spider-Man. Why can't he have organic web shooters?
Because if he did, they should come out of his butt.
Yeah, it's gross.
What do you mean it's gross?
I don't know. It's gross.
No, it should be. It's absurd. He's like, he does all these spider features, except he has to like.
But Peter Parker's also a scientific genius, so that's.
Also, it's really important that those webs are like chemically designed to dissolve after a little while, so he's not just like leaving smears of organic solidified super goop all over New York.
Really? We're fine.
It's just not my favorite thing element of those.
But you're very conservative when it comes to these like canonical comic book things, aren't you?
Is it the bodily fluid element that is too troublesome?
And then you know, you get in this whole loss of confidence, losing his powers, can't produce the fluid thing in this movie. It's like, it's maybe a little too grown up.
Even leaving aside the metaphorical aspect of that, although it's really hard to, because it really makes me roll my eyes, I'm not into it. I'm really not into he got his powers from a radioactive spider, but they only work if he's got Dumbo's feather in his hand. Like, the whole powers going away thing in this movie really does not work for me.
I like it. I think it's a grown-up.
Organic web shooters?
We're moving on. I like it, though. I think that's an adult problem. I mean, it's a film where he's developing adult problems. It's like, you know, life beats you up. You know, you kind of just want to curl up in a little ball and not do anything. And that's something we'll get into.
Let's not get personal. Let's not describe my life here. Come on.
Well, I mean,
all our lives.
I like it too.
Media. We always get.
Yeah, exactly. Like I haven't written anything I've loved in forever because, like, it's, you know, the world.
Because your web shooters don't work.
Yeah,
anymore.
Exactly. The world's got me down, and I can't shoot webs, and I can't write graphs. Oh. You know.
But can you bounce off a wall and be fine?
Depends how much I've had to drink.
Speaking
of wisecracks, I will admit, as not sold as I am on the whole losing the powers thing, the gag of him leaping from building to building yelling, I'm back. I laughed pretty hard at that.
That got a big laugh in this household of people with not great backs.
I have a quick question for you to address now before we move on. Mm-hmm. Just so it's out of the way. Animated spiders, do they creep you out too?
I can deal with them. I don't love them.
Okay.
We can talk about it with Into the Spider-Verse, if we want.
I just wanted to get that taken care of now.
Your friend and mine, Oliver Sava, is a comics guy and is my personal comics librarian who gives me things to read. And whenever
he's your comic sommelier.
Yes, exactly. And when
Eisner winning comic sommelier.
Indeed. And whenever he gives me a comic with a spider in it, he puts a little post-it note over the panel and just writes spider on it, so I know.
Wow.
He's so kind.
So I'm going to posit that it's in a weird place where, you know, I think superficially it has a lot more in common with an MCU movie. And the tonally, I think it's light enough to work as an MCU movie in some way. But I also feel like this is more aligned in some ways with the Christopher Nolan Batman films, where you have a single director coming in and sculpting a whole universe around a single character and having a clear vision for what that character could be. And I feel like MCU has, I'm not even making a judgment call here, but I feel like you're getting, that's made, been made increasingly impossible in MCU, where I think you have like these little pockets that the characters that are kind of crafted around particular characters. I feel like the Guardians movies in particular kind of have their own like sort of little universe. And I feel like the Thor movies, maybe not always the strongest efforts, but they definitely have like a distinctive look and feel. But I think also they're all always servicing this larger shared universe. And I think there's the Spider-Man movies and the Batman movies that came shortly after this were unburdened by that. And I think there are certain advantages to that as well.
I feel like this both kind of marked a changing point where we were crossing over from superheroes being largely dudes in suits, which never quite looked right. They never quite fit right, to suits that could be convincing when they were just actors, and to CGI that could be convincing, you know, where it wasn't always obvious that you're watching like a little digital wireframe thing move around. This feels like an important stepping stone along the way to like all CGI movies, essentially. I just watched Aquaman last night, and there are a lot of fight scenes in that movie that are not as good as the fight scenes in this. There's a lot of sequences of CGI characters doing like close quartered battles with each other that is not as convincing as what goes on in this movie. It just like from a special effects and a costuming and a combat standpoint, like this movie is better than movies that are being made right now.
Yeah, just a quick aside on Aquaman. There's a lot I like in that movie. I've been warming to it since the further I've gotten away from it, and I kind of want to see it again. I think my kid would probably like it. But you put that much, I've said it before on this podcast, but you put that many digital effects up on a screen, my brain kind of shuts down. Like, I don't really process what's happening at in any moment. You know, the fight scenes of that are, to me, they're not Suicide Squad level headache, but they're also kind of overwhelming.
That said, kind of one of the like go-to jokes or observations about bad modern superhero battles is, you know, they culminate in the hero fighting a big ball of energy.
Mm-hmm.
And Spider-Man 2 ends with fighting a big ball of energy. Yeah. Like, you know, like this set the precedent there. It's not blue energy. You know, modern superhero movies, it's always blue energy. But that did kind of make me laugh, given how much of a kind of a running joke, oh, he battles a big ball of energy, has become.
Another thing about the Raimi Spider-Man films is, I mean, you look at something like Aquaman, and one of Aquaman's flaws, or maybe it's a selling point for some, is that it takes place, as you say, in a very crowded CGI world where everywhere Aquaman goes, it's a billion like light up fish or a billion light up vehicles or a billion light up cities. And it all just feels, it's a huge artificial world that's just very clearly digital. The Spider-Man movies that Raimi made are so set in New York. Mm-hmm. They're so specific to New York in terms of, you know, except when they're being shot in Chicago. But in terms of the accents, in terms of the individual people that you meet, in terms of
The pizza,
the setting, the backgrounds, the corner bodegas, the crowds that kind of come around whenever a disaster happens. Like, these feel very place specific. And, you know, Spider-Man was always kind of place-specific in a way. You know, Batman lived in a made-up city. Superman lived in a made-up city. Spider-Man was your friendly, actual, existing neighborhood Spider-Man. This movie also just feels like part of a set of kind of turning points towards, like, the specificity of place in superhero movies.
Well, there's some more to talk about. We'll get into it with in the next episode. But Spider-Man 2, good movie. In conclusion...
The best movie, Tasha? Question mark.
To be continued. Next issue. All right. With that, we're gonna wind things down. We'll be right back with some feedback. Now it's time for feedback, when our listeners weigh in with their responses to recent episodes and anything else in the world of film. We're still waiting on some feedback for our pairing of Mean Girls and The Favorite. In the meantime, let's share some letters about other recent episodes. Scott, I believe you have something on Widows, right?
Correct. Kevin writes, on the subject of Widows, I was curious about the gang's thoughts on Carrie Coon playing sort of the Pete Best of the Widows team, curiously left out of the action, though not without explanation, and barely even warranting a mention in the discussion. I found it such an odd choice given the way it adds an asterisk to the film's premise and advertising, all of which paints Cynthia Erivo as an equal player in mourning rather than a late addition to the roster. I don't know if this reflects Linda LaPlante's original miniseries, but even if it does, it still strikes me as a plot point that would normally be shed to streamline the story for feature length. It's a good point.
Yeah, I'm sad we didn't talk about Carrie Coon on the podcast, because Carrie Coon's great, but she also is like not quite afterthought. As the letter says, there's explanation given for why her role is what it is, but you know, she is definitely removed from the action. And given that so much of that episode was devoted to explaining the reasons for the action to Tasha.
I just have like 14 more questions about what goes on in Widows.
Yeah. Since Tasha did not have a question about Carrie Coon's character.
No, I knew Kevin would have us covered.
Yeah. Thank you, Kevin.
I mean, I think that it gives the story a kind of like weird lumpy shape because you have this like late arriving heist member out of nowhere, and you have this person who in theory should be part of the story who isn't. But I feel like the setup for her being one of the widows is important, because otherwise she wouldn't be a character at all. Like, you would have, when she does turn up in the story, you would have no idea why she's there, and what comes out of her being there wouldn't be nearly as impactful as it is. It does come across as a weird story beat, mm-hmm. and I feel like she should have been more involved, but I'm into Carrie Coon being more involved in anything that she appears in.
Yeah, and she's always not involved enough. Like, you know, like Infinity War. It was like Carrie Coon's in Infinity War for like 90 seconds.
She's become like voice. One of the queens of the like underused, underseen, possibly shot 12 more scenes and was cut out of the story, like actors.
Except when she's on TV, then she gets then she gets amazing roles.
She's the drama equivalent of Judy Greer, I guess, maybe.
Yeah, I don't know that if Widows has a flaw, I think it is the scripting and the plotting and that feeling that they're just trying to cram so much that you wouldn't, I think, otherwise if you were doing an original screenplay rather than an adapted screenplay. I mean, you know, you don't necessarily have to know that this was adapted from a miniseries, or you know, could have been a book to feel like they're trying to put in a lot of stuff, and that you wouldn't naturally make the film this absurd, you know, as busy as it is, and as well orchestrated, I think, generally, as the movie is. It's got too much going on, and there are some imbalances, and I think Carrie Coon is definitely one of them.
Well, we'll always have the leftovers.
We also received a letter about our Shirkers Other Side of the Wind pairing that touches on some larger issues. Genevieve, would you like to read that one?
I would. Will writes, "I really enjoyed your pairing of The Other Side of the Wind and Shirkers." Thank you, Will. For me, the two films illustrated a generation gap that has emerged in film criticism. Gen Xers like myself and previous generations certainly hunted out new filmmakers, but we did have an established pantheon of classic auteurs like Welles, Hitchcock, Bergman, Kurosawa, etc. Millennials, however, having grown up with the DVD explosion and streaming services rather than video rentals, have access to an order of magnitude of newer films. The fact that a lot more of these films are being made by individuals other than non-white men brings a refreshing variety of perspectives and worldviews that the earlier canon simply didn't have. However, I wonder how much we're losing by losing this canon, or at least elements of it. As fellow Gen Xers, what do Scott, Tasha, and Keith think? And Genevieve, that's me, what's your perspective?
Do we accept the premise of this letter, though? I don't know if I necessarily accept the premise of this letter, but I don't necessarily have evidence either.
I see it playing out in my own life. Okay. Like when I looked back at this year when I was doing my list making, I'm like, every year I see more films from this year and fewer films from other years. Like we throw little noir parties at our place where we dig up some like old 50s through 70s noir films and revisit things we haven't seen. And occasionally my job will call on me to watch something classic for comparison. But for the most part, almost all of the non-2018 films that I saw this year, I saw for this podcast. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why we do a public service, and everybody should heap praise on us and send us money and whatnot for giving them an excuse to dig up older films. But it's harder and harder because I don't feel like I barely feel like I kept up on 2018 films, and I definitely am not doing enough to increase my knowledge of pre-2018 films this year.
Yeah, but do we feel that the younger generation is not watching the canon, is only watching newer films?
I think that's really individual. Yeah. You know, like I think it depends where your love of movies came from, how it developed, you know, maybe to a certain extent how you grew up or what you saw growing up. But I think like ascribing it to like a generational divide is maybe less accurate than just ascribing it to the different movie climate we're in now, which kind of speaks to what Tasha is talking about, where you have to like kind of make a decision between keeping up with the glut of stuff that is out there and readily available in so many different forms, or seeking out things that are maybe not necessarily as readily available or not as relevant to your job as a film critic, you know, and whether you make the time to make that part of your cinematic diet, I think is a very individual thing. Like I know some very young critics. I think of someone like Charles Bermesco, you know, who is very eager to dig way back in the canon.
And he knows his stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
His roommate Vikram Murty knows his stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So
hi guys,
Kevin McFarlane, Noah Cruikshank, like people who we used to get interns in at the AV Club that would be like in their very early 20s, and for the most part were really surprisingly well versed in the classics.
That said, I do think the interesting part of this letter is where Will notes that, you know, the fact that more of these films are being made by individuals other than non-white men brings a refreshing variety of perspectives. And I do think in recent years there has been a lot more pushback against the idea of the canon that mostly comprises films by white men as somehow infallible or more important than, you know, these more modern movies. And, you know, I think everyone kind of falls at different places on the spectrum in terms of how much they ascribe to that. But I think it is kind of an important part of your consideration of, like I said, what should be part of your film diet.
I would say, though, that the canon and kind of reacting against the canon is sort of a thing that's been that I can always remember doing. In fact, my major in college was comparative literature, which is just nothing full of people who were rebelling against the classics majors and the English majors and that sort of thing. What sort of, you know, dead European, you know, men we're reading. But, you know, I it's very hard anecdotally to really grasp what people are seeing, you know. I mean, because it really, you know, I mean, it, at a touch of a button you have access to a whole lot of stuff. I mean, I wish you had access to Filmstruck still, but that's all there. I mean, if I were a cinephile, you know, if I were a young person today, I feel like I'd still have plenty of opportunities to dig into the canon and seek out things. I mean,
you can watch Rebecca on YouTube.
Exactly. Oh my god.
With Filmstruck, gone, you can subscribe to the Criterion channel, become a charter member, help support them, get the same films.
I mean, I remember I'd see some films in at my college library, but you know, we would go on these little like road trips to this video store called Movies We're Seeing in Atlanta. It was like an hour and a half or 2 hours away, you know, to rent movies. It's like you don't have to do that anymore. But I will say I am sensitive to those occasions in which I'm reading writing by professionals who don't know their stuff. I mean, like
yeah, you've got mail.
Yes, exactly. I was going to say that exactly. Today there was a piece, you know, in the New York Times, but not one of their film writers. Amanda Hess is more of a general culture writer. Yeah. I would say, but she wrote a defense of You Got Mail, which is not a film I like that much, but it never made mention once of The Shop Around the Corner. It's like, boy, don't bury that masterpiece that influenced that You Got Mail remade. So I'm sensitive to those things, and I think the purpose of this podcast is to remind, you know, everyone, and to remind ourselves and to stay in touch with the past.
Yeah, I think it's a conversation between the past and the present. I think the people who are going to have something interesting to say are going to be omnivorous in what they consume, whether they're old Gen Xers like us or young up and comers like Genevieve.
think that the real threat is the canon disappearing. Just, you know, if Criterion Channel hadn't been picked up, if it hadn't been moving forward, like Filmstruck's disappearance would have just been the erasure of the ability to see a lot of films without spending a lot of money on physical items, which a lot of people don't want anymore.
Right. And one thing that has changed from when I was growing up is there's a lot more just kind of floating around on television. Like I remember I had the Leonard Maltin book and I looked for 3.5 and 4-star movies and watch them all. And just as an example, I just wrote something on Laurel and Hardy, you know, Laurel and Hardy movies to watch if you're going to enjoy the film Stan and Ollie. And, you know, I had to ask, well, where do people watch Laurel and Hardy anymore. It's not on television. It used to be on television all the time. And basically the best way to watch the Laurel and Hardy movies worth watching, or most of them anyway, is this 10-disc DVD box set that you have to tell people that, you know, you can get it cheaper, but it retails for $100. It's like, this turns up on TCM. You're just not going to be exposed to one of the greatest comic teams ever, you know, and people that are the you know, characters and, you know, actors that still exist as cultural icons without actually people necessarily being exposed to their thing. So what I'm saying is, spend $100, buy this box set, and you're really going to enjoy some great comedy.
Well, I mean, that is kind of the catch-22 of the streaming era. It's like, you can seek out whatever you want, but the joy of discovery is kind of gone. You can't just stumble upon things as easily as you.
I think there is that, though. Like, you know, on Prime, you dig on Prime and you find this weird stuff. Like, I remember talking about how, like, they have sort of a nostalgic associations with, like, finding certain types of torrent files on sites. Yeah. That, like, kind of like finding an old video.
Just sort of the mechanic of it has changed from, you know, flipping channels to flipping through the categories on your streaming service.
And from going to your local DVD rental store to finding things that people have uploaded to YouTube, or checking out Nicholas Winding Refn's site where he's, like, uploading all kinds of, like, crazy stuff that he's gotten the rights to.
INWR.com. It's an amazing site for a very unusual selection of films. We always appreciate it when our listeners share their thoughts and their recommendations so we can feature them on a future episode or post on Facebook for discussion. To reach us, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. That's it for this episode of The Next Picture Show. In part two, we'll jump deeper into the Spider-Verse with Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. Look for that next Tuesday, or better yet, subscribe to The Next Picture Show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your podcatcher of choice. Find us at nextpictureshow.net, follow us at facebook.com/nextpictureshow, and follow us on Twitter at nextpicturepod, so you'll always know when a new episode drops. Until then, remember to keep your Spidey suit clean and ready, because you never know when you'll need it.
In the chill of night, at the scene of a crime, like a streak of light, he arrives just in time. Spider-Man, Spider-Man, friendly neighborhood Spider-Man, welcome fame, he's ignored. Action is his reward to him. Life is a great big hang-up. Wherever there's a hang-up, you'll find a spider.